My name is Jasmine Davila, and my favorite thing is the work of Lori Colquhoun.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hi there, this is Leah Jones. I am your host of the podcast Finding Favorites. The interview you are about to hear is the very first interview that I recorded for this podcast on the Friday night of Memorial Day weekend in 2020. It's with my dear friend Jasmine Davila, and we got together. I gave her the choice between the author Lori Colquhoun and her favorite Tom Hiddleston. She picked Lori, and then we spent a lot of time talking about Tom. So when you hear references to Tom, that we are talking about Tom Hiddleston. I'm so happy that you are giving this podcast a try. It is something I've been thinking about for a while, but took 2 months of quarantine, 2 months of shelter in place to finally solidify an idea that I thought was worth buying a microphone and some mixing software and joining the masses as a podcaster. So please enjoy this interview with Jasmine Davila.
This is the very first interview I'm ever recording for my podcast,
Finding
Favorites. This happened just this week. I wrote a blog post, which I also hadn't done in like 6 months. And in it, I traced how I got from the West Wing Weekly to How Did This Get Made to Doughboys. So I traced my podcast journey in a paragraph. And then that wasn't enough, so I drew a mind map on a giant post-it note in my hallway.
I saw that. I saw the picture, rather, that she posted of that.
And then that wasn't enough. So then I made a mind map on an app where I tracked, like, every media that I could think of that I got into from listening to How Did This Get Made, like a giant spider chart. It was ridiculous.
Have you already tweeted it to the hosts of How Did This Get Made?
No, my plan is that I will record a bunch of these.
Yeah.
I'll become a new and notable on iTunes.
Oh, yes, of course.
And then the host of How Did This Get Made can discover this and realize it's their number one fan in Chicago who's only a little creepy into the podcast. But generally, I'm a very polite fan. I write thank you notes and I don't touch people. And then a friend of mine from college sent me a DM on Twitter, and he said, I was so inspired by your mind map about How Did This Get Made that I drew my own. And he tracked his journey from Best Week Ever, then to Paul F. Tompkins and Paul Scheer, and how that got him to a whole world of comedy. And I was like, you know what, this is a fun conversation, because everybody has a favorite thing that they got to without the help of the Netflix algorithm, without the Amazon algorithm, and you took a winding path to get there. And then after you loved this thing, whatever it is, it took you to a whole new world of media, of art, of fandom. So I was just like, I want to hear from my friends, and in the future from celebrities, how did they find their favorite thing? What got them there? And what did it take them to? So that's where it came from.
I think that's a fine idea.
Thank you.
I think that's a good thing. It's also partly like, you know, person's origin, you know, your guest's origin story. Because everyone fancies himself, like, you know, the hero of their own, like, comic book or comic or a superhero story. So that, yeah, realizing what it is that you, what it is that you like you really like, is so important in figuring out who you are or what you like or what you dislike. Also, I don't know, it just feels a lot more enlivening to actually talk about like what it is that you like or you deeply love, and to try to like to try to sort of share that with people, and also try to convince people that this is something they should be invested in as well.
Yeah. Yes. And I think, you know, for the record, for the podcast record, I am starting this on like week 9 of the 2020 COVID shelter in place order. And so this desire to talk about people's favorite things comes from living isolated in a world of anxiety and more anxiety about our future. So I this chance to hear from people about stories from their past, and just, it's really fun to hear people gush about the things they love. Mm. You know, I think it's part of, maybe we should tell people how we know each other, but it's part of what I think makes Saturday Night Movie so fun.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And we should definitely talk about that. So maybe, yeah. I guess we do have to talk about Tom as well, if we're going to talk about.
Yes.
If we're going to talk about that, we have to tell people about Horny on Maine.
Would you like to describe Horny on Maine?
I would, but you know, actually I feel like there is a story I have. It's sort of a place where the two loves or my two likes that we're going to talk about for the work of Tom Hiddleston and the work of Laurie Colwin sort of intersect. And this is a story that I've told, like, you know, at different live lit shows in Chicago. So if anyone, whoever's listening to this, if you're not familiar with live lit, then Google it or come to Chicago and find me and I will tell you all about it. Like in the fall of 2018, there was like this big con, you know, like a big show that came to Chicago where for several hundred dollars, you can go and meet, you know, meet your favorite actor and get, you know, and spend another couple hundred dollars and get like their autograph. And this is an opportunity for me to meet Tom Hiddleston with a bunch of my friends who are also fans of his as well. And I remember there being a lot of discussion, like both online and then like amongst my friends, like what were we going to get signed by him.
Put so much pressure on ourselves for those glimpses,
right? Because this moment somehow has to. It's just a moment. It's like the photo was like maybe all like 30 seconds. Like the autograph signing was maybe 90 seconds if that. And there is like an immense pressure, both like sort of, you know, sort of externally, but also within myself, that I had to find like the perfect thing to write like for him to sign. And then I have to come up with like the perfect funny little thing for him to say, you know, for me to say, if he happened to say anything to me. And then I realized that, like, you know, logistics of it all is that it didn't really matter, like, to him what it was he was going to sign for me, right? So right. It was going to be, it mattered to me what he was going to sign for me. And it seems obvious, but, like, you know, you don't know, like, the number of people who will go to these things, like, these sort of opportunities and, like, bring gifts for the artist, like, you know, and, like, fan art and, like, fan fiction and, like, you know, tea and, like, all this other stuff. And I just remember thinking, there is no way in hell I'm gonna bring this dude one more thing he has to pack in his suitcase to take home or wherever he's going to after this. Like, that's not, I'm paying this money, he's gonna sign something for me to keep. But I didn't, like, I couldn't think of anything. Like, I didn't have a DVD that I wanted him to sign, or like, I like Shakespeare and he's like, you know, so Tom Hiddleston's like, you know, a great Shakespearean actor, but I don't love Shakespeare. And I know that's like, so, like, might make me something of a pariah within like the Tom Hiddleston fandom, but that's like a discussion for another show at another time. So I don't love the plays as of Shakespeare so much as I love the sonnets, but none of the sonnets really worked for me either. And then I remember that, like, you know, being a fan of Tom and also being a writer means that, like, yeah, it's 99% likely that I'm a fan fiction writer as well. So I was like, I never went to the point where, like, yeah, I'll totally have him sign a piece of my fan fiction, because that's fucking, no, that's crazy. Like,
that pushes yeah. boundaries.
Yeah, that's a lot of like, no, that's totally not happening. That would be too much for me. But I do remember writing something where I quoted Laurie Colwin in it. And I was like, oh, well, that's a story that makes me think of like a particular iteration of Tom that I write in my fan fiction. I was like, oh, maybe I could get him to sign like the first page of this thing that like it makes me think of him. And so I did. And so I brought, that's what I brought in.
So you brought your book.
Brought in this book, a collection of her short stories, and had him sign like the first page, or like the first page facing the first page of the story that makes me think of him the most, or makes me think of him. And of course, like, you know, the moment comes, like, you know, he's sitting there, I'd already had my picture with him. So I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, you know what? I'm not nervous anymore. I'm an old pro at this. And I put my, you know, and you're supposed to sort of hand over your thing to like an assistant or like, you know, someone who's sort of sitting there before. They, like, you know, they spell out your name if you want it addressed to you, and as everyone does, and they stick it, like, you know, sort of in the spot, like, on the book where it's going to be signed. And, like, it was so brief. It was very much like, you know, sees my name, like, okay, fine, like, you know, dude, and then, like, you know, I'm Tom Hiddleston. And he took, like, a second to look at the cover of the book, and then, like, a cover of thing. And I'm like, is he going to ask me about this? Because I didn't want to be the person who's like, oh, let me tell you all about it, knowing that there are like 600 people, you know, who would come before me, and 600 people are going to come after, are all going to be like, I need to take this opportunity to tell you. Like, I was very conscious of not wanting to take up more space and time than I needed to, like, in this moment.
Yeah. It reminds me of, do you ever watch the TV show Wings?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So one of the will they, won't they relationships in that, the only line I remember from Wings, or that I attribute to Wings and is not from it, was the will they, won't they couple. He gave her a birthday present, and this, what he signed in it was, saw this and thought of you, see everything and think of you. That makes me think of, you took him, instead of a big, one of his, because he's Thor, or he's?
He's Loki.
He's Loki.
He auditioned for Thor. If you look on the internet, you will find like the video from his Thor audition, and it's kind of hilarious because he looks like a little surfer boy with like, it's funny. It's just funny to me. Not like hilarious. Well, yeah, it is pretty funny, but yeah.
So you could have like brought one of the Avengers movies like everyone else, but instead you brought something that you read this, you think of him. Nobody has ever brought him a Laurie Colwin group selection of short stories. So you gave him a little blip of like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Even though he didn't get to sit in it and sit with you and have the conversation it deserved, you gave him, I think, a moment that changed the monotony of what those meet and greets must be like.
I mean, I like to hope so. And I feel like maybe that's a little asshole-ish of me to be like, oh, well, I'm not like the other girls. I'm not like the other fans. I'm special. And I will certainly cop to having that feeling. I think because when it comes to my fandom, like when it comes to being a fan of Tom and like being a fan of Laurie, to sort of like try to connect the two, it's like, they're like things that I sort of don't necessarily like try not to participate in, I guess. Like an example of that is being like, you know, when everyone, it seems to me, like in the fandom sort of piles on and sort of like gets into sort of like this weird contest about like if he happens to announce like a new project, for example. Like, for example, I'm going to be starring in a revival of Harold Pinter's portrayal and like on the stage in London. I'm going to do it in New York. And then, you know, that gets announced. And all of a sudden, I had no idea that the Tom Hiddleston fandom was full of so many Harold Pinter scholars.
Yeah, right.
I had no idea that there are so many people who were experts and like had written, like possibly written imaginary theses or could have written theses, like, you know, on Pinter's later work as a,
yeah,
you know, as a, you know, as a playwright, as, you know, just as a writer in general. I mean, he won a Nobel Prize. So, I mean, it's not impossible that like there are lots of people out there, you know, who are great, you know, who are experts on Pinter's oeuvre. I didn't know that so many of them were in the Tom Hiddleston fandom though.
Yeah. The overlap in the Venn diagram of Tom Hiddleston fans, yeah, Harold Pinter scholars.
Yeah. I didn't know it was a circle.
The overlap only includes like the director of the play.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be like, yeah, it would be Jamie Lloyd, the guy who directed the play.
Right.
And maybe like the widow, like, yeah, Harold Pinter's widow, maybe. You know, and maybe, yeah, and I think that's about it. And then when it comes to Laurie, it's like, I feel like every few years there's some sort of precious, sort of pseudo winsome, like nice white lady food writer who discovers her or is like, oh yes, Laurie Colwin is like too pure for this world and written all these beautiful essays on like the art of like being alone and like cooking and, you know, she like, you know, she's a domestic, like sensualism, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, I guess that's true, but it's not like I knew her, like I was one degree of separation from her, but again, like very tenuous, but every time, like I read, like I feel like I'm always reading like some essay, like someone in BuzzFeed or even the New York Times is like, oh, I wonder, like, you know, oh, she made like the most perfect roast chicken and like this. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't know. I don't feel like I know Laurie like any better just because I read her work like so many times, because I am just so much that older. I've been reading her since I was like 17.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think that it's like, I think it, with the way that I feel about her work and the way that I feel about Tom Hiddleston's work is the way that a lot of people feel about the things they love. It's that they want to sort of, they don't want them. You don't want to overdo it. You don't want to kill it.
Right.
In the, in belaboring and like going over and like sort of going over it and sort of picking apart every little thing that you do, which fortunately you can't really, and I can't believe you said fortunately, I take that back, which you can't really do with Lori Coleman because she passed away like a long time ago. She passed away like maybe the year that I started reading her, right? Whereas with Tom, he's alive and well, though there have been highs and lows in that experience for myself as well as for other fans in terms of following his career, what we perceive as sort of going on in his personal life. It's like, you know, you're always sort of challenging. I'm always like sort of challenging myself or feel like he's challenging me exactly how invested do I want to get in him as a person,
yeah,
versus him just as a as like a character, like, you know, in my work or just like as a public figure who I don't know and don't have any right to know about.
Someone told me about the concept of parasocial relationships. Parasocial relationships are one way. They're the relationships that we have with a character or an actor or an author, that we are getting the benefits of a relationship by watching a show, by following a career, by listening to a podcast. We're having intimate relationships, but they're one way. And so there is a moment where you catch yourself and you are deeply loving an actor or you're active in a fandom. And then you realize, like, I'm involved in a relationship, an intimate relationship.
Yeah.
Through the things that come in my ears, through things that come in my eyes. And they are involved in a transactional relationship with me.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because I pay for that relationship. Like, I pay to attend a live podcast. I pay for a VIP so I can go backstage so I can get a photograph.
Right.
And it's...
Or in my case, I paid, you know, to go to Navy Pier on early on a Saturday morning with a bunch of my friends where we all paid for the same transaction because we're all reaching the same milestone in our parasocial relationships with this guy.
Right.
And it makes me, and I am so, I'm always aware of that. And I think that I've always been aware of that, like even at the very beginning of sort of entering the fandom, like being, like going from being aware and like liking this guy to being like, oh my God, he's my absolute favorite. Like, I want to know everything about him. I want to know everything, what he's doing. And I think I was always aware of that because I came into the fandom at a time right after he had, like, you know, done a bunch of movies. He'd already played Loki twice in, like, in the Marvel Universe.
So are you a carpetbagger to the Tom Hiddleston?
I don't know. I think maybe some people would say that I would. Like, I remember hearing about, like, sort of old school fans, like fans who had known about him, like, you know, who were aware of him, like, you know, since like 2007 or 2008 when he started, like, doing, like, you know, started doing like film appearances or like doing stuff on TV, or like, oh, I got to see him like when he was in this little theater company. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm so old school. Like, you know, I'm a longer fan, and like, I know everything about Shakespeare. I know what Shakespeare plays he's been in, and like, you know, and therefore I am higher up the ladder than you people who've only seen him in, like, you know, like the two Thor movies. And And that's fine, but I think that when it's weird because I think that you sort of go through, because again, this is a podcast about like finding your favorites, like what is your favorite, who is your favorite, why do you like them so much, and then you sort of learn that there are sort of right ways and wrong ways to like something.
Mm-hmm.
Not when you're not the only person who likes a person, when you're in fact part of a community that has a name, that are called Hillstoners, because these are gatekeepers. And gatekeeping in fandom, that is nothing new, but the way that the gatekeeping is sort of performed and how it can only really be performed by certain people.
Right. Like, can't we just like the thing we like and talk?
No, you absolutely can't just like it. No, not at all. The answer to that is always no. You can't just like a person. You have to like the right things. You have to like, you know, just dump, you have to like everything. And the second you take pause and say, you know what, maybe he shouldn't have gone out with that person, which is like a whole, like, again, like a huge thing. Or maybe that was like not the best thing to say during your Golden Globes award speech. It's like you're immediately like accused of being a traitor or disloyal, or you don't like him as much and therefore you lose points. And I'm just like, no, I really don't. I think I just maybe tend to think a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think there has to be room to love something and be a critical thinker. And to have your own reactions and not just like move with the crowd of fans on how you like a thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And just knowing that. Yeah. And honestly, it makes it, I mean, that's a way to sort of keep to stay engaged, because I can't just sort of blanket just like Tom Hiddleston the way that I just sort of like have a blanket love for like 90 Day Fiance. Right. You know, I think it's a question of like, it's a question of expectation.
Before we turned the microphones on, you started talking about how you got to the Lori Colwyn books.
Right. Yeah. So that was like, I must have been, I want to say a junior or maybe even a sophomore in high school. And the school that I went to, we had like two different libraries at the time. Like the building, the school has since expanded, like, you know, it's all different now, but there used to be like a lower school library, and you know, just all like, you know, like for K through fourth grade, and then middle school and upper school, because you don't have upper school when it's a private school. You go to upper school, you don't go to high school like the rest of you plebs. Okay. So that was like,
well, I'm so old that I went to junior high and
oh my gosh, that's so rare.
In my hometown now there's middle school and high school. Like there, junior high is not even a thing anymore, but I went to public school in Indiana.
Yeah. This is when I was in private school, but for like the few years that I was in public school in New York City, like in the 80s, like it wasn't junior high. It was IS. It was intermediate, because PS wouldn't be public school. It was primary. It was a wild time. I barely remember it. But then I started going to private school. And so I'd go to the library a lot because like, I just loved this building that the school was housed in, and the library, like the middle school, like upper school library was great, because like, you know, you walk in, there are like these little carrels, and like, you know, like the bookshelves are all like really big and sturdy and heavy enough that you could climb them, even though of course you were not allowed to.
You weren't supposed to, but.
But I mean, it's like, dude, they're huge ladders, and like, you know, and I'm like, you know, 17, and I'm trying to climb to like, you know, get like the copy of like, I don't know, some D.H. Lawrence novel or something at the very top. Like, I'm going to climb that bookcase is what I'm saying.
They put those big sturdy bookcases in because they knew there was no stopping teenage girls from climbing to get to their
book. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Like there, you weren't going to stop us. I think she might have been recommended to me by the woman who ultimately gave me my first Lori book.
Who was that person?
So that woman was a woman by the name of Frances Tolliver. And I will always remember her for a number of things. Namely, is that like she was super nice, but she was like the sort of like, you know, sort of low key, like very powerful sort of person. As in, like she was like, she'd been the college advisor at my school for like years and years and years. And so her pull, her ability to get girls into like, to get like multiple girls into like all of the Ivies of their choices, like was legendary. Like, you know, she was pretty much unstoppable. So of course, the year that I became a senior, she was not my college advisor because she decided to retire from that. She taught English, like, you know, in the upper school. And I had never actually had her as a teacher until my senior year. And all the seniors, like, you know, you really don't have to do anything else except for your spring project. So if your spring project is you're going to write a paper, that's great. Your spring project is you're going to like go work as an intern at like your dad's law firm. That's another thing too. I think I just took classes. I just took two classes. I continued taking Spanish, and I took a creative writing class with her. It was me and two other girls in my grade. And we just like wrote, like we basically just met in the cafeteria. We wrote short stories. I couldn't for the life of me tell you what my stories were about. And she told us what books to read, and she told me to read Lori Colwyn. I think I'd already read one of her books or two of her books at that point. She's like, okay, great. Well, you know, I don't think Ms. Tolliver said like, oh yeah, she was a friend of mine. And like, she was this totally famous food writer, whatever. She was just like, I think you would really like her.
Yeah. So when I think of Lori Colwyn, you gave me two of her books.
Mm-hmm.
I think of, I'm like, there are these beautiful essays that have recipes in them.
Yeah.
And so I didn't read it thinking like, this is amazing food writing. I was like, the way she describes having a dinner party.
Yeah.
When she tells you how to make a roast chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful writing. I assume really good recipes. I haven't actually made any of her recipes.
Yeah.
But But you gave me those books maybe 3 to 5 years ago. So in my 30s, going on 40s, what was it like being 17, reading this old white lady in London talking about throwing a dinner party? How did you connect to that?
I didn't get to the home cooking books until I was in college, actually. Oh. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I think because of the really, it never occurred to me, I don't think of myself as a good reader. And when I say a good reader, someone who reads voraciously, who reads different things all the time. I read the same things over and over again. And I especially abuse it, and I tend to exploit that behavior a lot when it comes to reading Laurie, because I love reading things that are comforting and things that feel truthful and honest, but not unkind. So, which is probably why, for example, I love Beverly Cleary, but not her kids' book so much, because there are these four young adult novels that she wrote between years 1953 and 1962, which are just so good. But I don't think anyone ever talks about them because you think of Beverly Cleary, you think of Ramona and Beezus and her kids' books, and those are great. But I'm no. Young adult. Yeah, they're called 15, Sister of the Bride, The Luckiest Girl, and Jean and Johnny.
Okay.
If you read one, read 15, because that to this day messes me up. Because it just perfectly describes being 15 and a 15-year-old girl and not popular and sort of unsure, but also very excited about the idea that this boy who delivers horse meat to the dogs, to the households of the people that you sit for, might actually be interested in you. It's incredible. And and they haven't been updated to be made more contemporary. There's this sort of dodgy bit where she and all the other cute white friends from high school go to Chinatown for an exotic dinner, and that's kind of sketchy, but it was also 1957, so
right.
That's exactly what it was like, and that's what I want. So to go back to Laurie, I think once I got into home cooking, but then even before that, when I was reading Goodbye Without Leaving, which is funny because I sometimes wonder if Mrs. Tolliver gave me that one on purpose, because the main character of that is this white lady in the 60s who drops out of her PhD program at the University of Chicago and becomes a backup singer for a group that sounds a lot like Ike and Tina Turner.
Wow.
It's a wild story. And I didn't even really make the connection when I read it. I was like, oh yeah, Geraldine, wait a second. Geraldine went to the University of Chicago. I'm going to the University of Chicago. Is this what Mrs. Tolliver thinks I should do? I should finish or drop out and go join a band. And I was like, I probably, probably could do that if I really wanted to. And I think that for me, the way that Laurie wrote women, and I don't know if I've ever read if I've ever read anything of hers that was written by the point of view of a man.
I don't think I knew she wrote nonfiction.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that she wrote fiction.
Oh, yeah, she writes fiction. I'm sorry. That's. I feel like a bad friend. I totally should have given you a copy of, oh, my God, you know what you would absolutely love? Definitely, you need to go. I will buy you a copy of this, or I'll send it to you. You need to read Happy All the Time.
Happy All the Time. All right. I have her Amazon page open. And I will get something from an independent bookstore like Women and Children First. I won't order it from Amazon, but it's the easiest way to look at all her titles. Okay.
Yeah. The thing about Laurie's books is that I think every few years they get reprinted. They're never out of print, but they're almost always the kind of book you have to have the bookstore order, no matter if the bookstore is Barnes and Noble or if it's Women and Children First or Unabridged or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that what we came down for Laurie is that the way that her characters, and first, because their novels are very short, they're short, and then the essay collections, or not the essay collection, but the short story collections, everything's really, I think one thing I like about is they're not overly long.
She's not writing Infinite Jest.
She's not writing Infinite Jest. She's not trying to write, she's not trying to write Persuasion, which is another book, not by Lord Colin, by Jane Austen, that I read over and over again. Because I think she cared a lot about the way, and then she wrote about this a lot in her essays too, in Home Cooking, More Home, in the food writing that she does. She cares about how people live, how they eat, the homes that they make for themselves, why they, what it is, why they're having dinner, the way that they are, why are they eating it, or what is it they're eating, what do they choose to read. And I don't know if I'm making this sound super pretentious, every single, all these little, these seemingly insignificant decisions are like, it are actually super important because they lead the character. And that's more like, I'm just sort of, she wrote characters that I was deeply interested in knowing, even though they were not necessarily characters that I would, I think it took me a while to sort of, it took me a while to allow myself to like them and to recognize them and to be friends with them because I was not, like, you know, sort of like an upper middle class, like, white girl from Philadelphia or from the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Like, right, like a lot of the characters were in these stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when your high school teacher says, oh, Jasmine, you're going to University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a book about a woman who went there and dropped out to be creative.
Yeah.
It's hard not to read into that. Is she saying you're making the wrong decision in your life?
Yeah.
Or is she saying, here's a protagonist who's a powerful woman who's going, mm-hmm. who went to University of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to set your imagination on fire.
Yeah. And I think that just got me thinking that people were having ordinary lives and that these ordinary lives are worth talking about.
Yeah.
Or worth reading about. And so I think that's always sort of what I've looked for in the books that I read now. Like, I don't know if there's like a pattern. I think I'm just sort of in, like, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I'm always interested in sort of what I would call like ordinary people, like people who are not heroes. Like when when there are memoirs that get published about people who beat like seemingly impossible odds or, you know, like, you know, did all these things to like, you know, come back from your death. I'm like, yeah, that's good for them. Because I think and part of it could be because I'm a hater, as you all know.
I do know that.
But also, I think that I have a problem with people who sort of, whether they mean to or not, sort of end up inspiring others to do better. I don't. I'm always a little wary of heroes. People who seem to sort of slip a little too easily into that role.
Yep.
Which is probably why. But like, you know, sort of. This doesn't mean, I don't know, which is probably why I like dog rescues so much, like following all sorts of pet rescues, like on social media, because like these people are just like, it don't strike me as having a hero complex. Like, sorry, that's like a little off topic, but yeah, I'm not so much into heroism. I don't really care about heroics and like big grand gestures like that. I mean, romantic ones, oh sure, but like when it comes to things like I live a life of inspiration because I'm an inspirational person, like that doesn't mean anything to me.
Right. It makes me think of the photographs of Vivian Mayer, that Chicago street photographer who was Annie and died in obscurity, and then
and now someone is making like a lot of money off of her work now. I think it might be a distant relative. I feel like as long as it's a relation, that's fine. But I guess I like the idea that that ordinary lives and like ordinary characters are special, and that they're worth talking and they're worth thinking about, and they're worth loving. So, and I think that's where Laurie like really gets me, because like, you know, her characters like, you know, are not without their quirks and their eccentricities, but they're not like sort of, I don't feel like they're sort of put there in order for me to sort of instantly emulate. They're for me to sort of to get to know and to recognize, and that's always been much more fruitful. And so, of course, like, I guess like when it comes to sort of like my other love for Tom Hiddleston's work is that it's weird. Like, I feel like he's sort of been, I don't, like, you know, God forbid he ever, like someone he in a circle or like friggin' listens to this, is that he's always struggling to find like the right part that will sort of center him properly. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I sort of dread when that day comes, you know, when he like plays like the perfect, and like certainly there have been attempts at that in his career that like, you know, some more successful than others.
You think he's had attempts to play the perfect role that like he could carry on top of my career?
Like if things were different, like he would be like an A-list, like he would be like like, it's funny, it reminds me of, like, a conversation that my brother Patrick and I once about, because we talk about pop culture stuff all the time, and we were talking about Bradley Cooper, and I think this was maybe A Star Is Born had just been announced as a project. It had been just announced that Bradley Cooper was going to be, like, readapting and, like, you know, writing and directing a new adaptation of the film, and Lady Gaga was going to play the lead after, you know, after that part had been sort of vacant for years, and I think my brother started it. Like, he was like, I think that feels like the sort of thing that, he's like, Tom's a really good actor. He's like, the things that I've seen him in, even the Marvel movies, like he's clearly just sort of like at a different level. But why is it that like, you know, sort of outside of the Marvel universe, like, you know, his successes or like his sort of visibility in certain roles have not been as good. And I'm just like, maybe, and I just remember thinking like, it's not for question of talent. Maybe it's just like, he's not getting the right scripts. Or I think he actually once said, like once in an interview, in a couple of interviews, that for a while, like it felt like whenever he was getting scripts, these were clearly scripts that had been rejected by like Benedict Cumberbatch or like Michael Fassbender or guys who were just like a little bit ahead of him or a little bit older.
Right.
Maybe not necessarily more talented, just sort of like a little more ahead or a little more out there. Like, you know, like Benedict Cumberbatch, like, you know, he played Sherlock, and Michael Fassbender, you know, got into the X-Men movies, like, you know, just a little bit ahead of, you know, sort of like the Marvel universe sort of taking off. And so,
so Tom is like the more affordable
bird. Yeah. Yeah. Which is a weird thing to say, because it seems like you don't want to like go to the next, but he's like, oh, he's like the budget Michael Fassbender. He's like,
right.
Or like the off brand Benedict Cumberbatch. Like, he's not, like, I think he's like a much better actor than those two guys. I think that.
But do you think perhaps he has said, I'm going to take my Avengers money, and I'm thinking of Daniel Radcliffe from Harry Potter.
Right.
He doesn't have to make any commercial choices for the rest of his life.
Probably not.
Has Tom made enough money on Marvel,
right,
that he can just make art?
I think that by this point he has, and this is something that I've discussed a lot with like my friends within the fan, with my brother as well, is that I think that, and sort of that they were taking a big gamble on the first MCU movie, which is Iron Man, because at the time Robert Downey Jr. had only been a few years out of rehab after hitting rock bottom. He had appeared in one movie, which I still haven't seen, by Shane Black and Jon Favreau, you know, who directed and I believe also wrote the first Iron Man movie, as well as subsequent ones. And he's sort of, I guess, like renowned or sort of known in Hollywood for like when he gets like sort of fixated on casting a person in a particular role, like he will fight like super hard and like will be immovable. And so the first person he was sort of known to be like that was Robert Downey Jr. to play Tony Stark, to play Iron Man, right?
Wow.
And so Downey Jr., like, you know, he's just, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't already seen Endgame, Iron Man dies in that one. But this is like, yeah, 10 years since the first one. But as far as you know, like, you know, because he was so successful, and I guess he was really good at negotiating his contract, Robert Downey Jr. has made a lot of money. So like, he's definitely the kind of guy who's like, I don't ever have to like take another paycheck role ever again.
Right.
And then coming in right after him, I think, is probably Scarlett Johansson. But I think when it comes to sort of like some of the other Avengers, like Chris Hemsworth, supposedly he's made a ton of money because he has like his own Thor movies. And I think Tom was sort of like, I think when it came to getting paid, like, I don't think he quite got as much as like the other Avengers, because like, you know, he's sort of a supporting character. He just unexpectedly ended up being like the scene stealer for a lot of people at least in the Thor movie, and definitely in the first Avengers movie, where sure. He was the villain and he was like very charismatic and like you couldn't help but like him, even though you know that he was like the bad guy, and he's just so cute. And oh my God, he has that fancy posh British accent and like, you know, all this other stuff.
You're saying he might not have made us fuck you money yet.
No, I don't think that he made his fucking money until he signed a deal with Disney Plus. So they all went to Atlanta, I guess, like in January, February to start pre-production. Like, the show is going to go into production like the summer, fall, and then air on Disney Plus next year. But then coronavirus happened and everyone's in quarantine. So as far as I know, all those guys, including Tom, are still under stay-at-home orders in like the greater Atlanta area.
So they can do whatever they want.
George
doesn't care.
Yeah, exactly.
Care.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I don't think he made any real. I think he made the money. Maybe he got bonuses from like his appearances, you know, after the Avengers, certainly. But then if you saw like the third and fourth, the third Thor movie, like he was in it, and like the other Avengers movies, like he was in them, but he wasn't in them a ton. Like, his character got killed off. So I think it's more like, there is no way that they could possibly justify paying him like $25 million for like a 15-minute appearance in like one of the second to last, right, Avengers movie, right? But they could renegotiate with him and give him a producer credit with the potential of making more money and doing it with Disney. Like, you know, if he hadn't had I think if Loki hadn't happened, the TV show, I think most likely he'd still be sort of hustling or like either working to try to do more production, like producing stuff, or sort of still trying to find like a franchise like he did like famously 4 years ago when he was very publicly sort of in the running to assume the role of James Bond after Daniel Craig retired. But that sort of coincided with some personal choices that might have actually ended up completely defeating that whole thing. And yeah. I think that to some people, both within the fandom, like especially in the fandom, were like, oh, he never came back from that. Like, you know, I can't forgive him for that. I can't ever be friends, be a fan of his ever again because he did that thing. And I'm like,
yeah,
I get it, but also get over yourself.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to wrestle you back to Lori. Ah,
if you insist. Sure.
I insist.
To Lori.
I mean, maybe we should have just accepted from the top that you really wanted to talk about Tom.
I know. It's like, it's weird. I didn't mean to yelp, but it's funny because I always feel like I'm in denial about wanting to talk about him all the time.
But
it's an interesting time because I think the first year that I wrote fan fiction, I wrote so much and then it just started going up less and less and less. And not because so much of like what was going on with him, but so much of what was going on with me. So when I got really sick at the end of 2018 and I was like, oh gosh, I don't know. Like, I'm sure I'll write something and, you know, and we'll just see how I feel. And I remember telling people who read me, it's not like I have a lot of readers, but the people who do read me, like, you know, very dedicated and I can't thank them enough for just like, what's going on? And I was like, so I got a little cancer. And I gotta focus on this. Got a little cancer, and I had surgery and I had radiation, but I don't have like the energy or the inclination to do anything, let alone write fan fiction about this dude.
Yeah.
And so yeah, that, I can't believe it's taken me, and it's been so spotty. And so I wrote something this week, and I was like, I don't even know where that came from. Maybe it's finally, it's just, maybe it's being unemployed now as well as feeling.
I think the first 8 weeks of the quarantine or stay at home order, whatever we're supposed to call it.
Mm-hmm.
The first 2 months.
Yeah.
We were just marinating in our own stew.
Yes.
Like, we're home. You and I both are single women. We live alone.
Mm-hmm.
We are very connected digitally, but very isolated physically.
For sure.
From our people.
Mm-hmm.
You are isolated from all the fur friends.
Yes.
Like all the puppies and kitties around the city who love you.
Right.
Which is so hard. Mm-hmm. And I feel like after 2 months, we were both like, fuck it. I got shit to say.
Yeah.
I have a podcast. I need to write. Like it's been baking. For 2 months of this fucking quarantine.
Yeah. I think Horny on Main was just like part of it, like the movie series.
Yes.
So yeah. So I guess I'd explain to people who are just like, what are these two horny old ladies talking about? So
we're not old. We are very cool single ladies.
We are in the
together. let's be honest, they're your friends, not mine. But yeah. I'm making them my friends.
Yeah, they are your friends.
Together every Saturday night to watch the movies that made us horny when we were younger.
Yeah, and so Young Guns and The Lost Boys, which we watched last week, were interesting because like it sort of brought us back to being teenagers. But I also remember like not being super into Kiefer Sutherland in particular when I was that age, and also I had never seen Young Guns, which is the movie we watched 2 weeks ago before, and that was a shit show, but an enjoyable shit show. I can see why like it did so well at the box office.
I am the one who brought Lost Boys and Young Guns to the group.
Yeah.
And I will say that I my middle school social group was, are you Kiefer Sutherland or are you into Christian Slater?
Those were
our North Stars.
Yes.
And you were a Kiefer girl or a Christian girl.
Yeah.
Not religious, but like, so Young Guns, Lost Boys, Heather's, Young Guns 2, which gets Christian involved.
Yeah, I think we've already agreed that we're going to watch Young Guns 2 because of Christian Slater, but I wanted to watch Unpump the Volume first.
Yes.
Because that's a horny Christian Slater movie. Heather's not so much.
No, Heather's is There's nothing horny about Heather.
No, no, not at all. Like, it's campy and it's hilarious and it's like a brilliant movie, but like for the purpose of this series, which is basically sort of like, you know, to get, you know, get, you know, to get your Gen X knickers in a twist, that ain't it. Which is why I'm excited. But I think that after 2 weeks of sort of watching movies that came out when we were teenagers, I'm sort of excited to get back to watching movies where we feel a little bit closer to our age. So the yeah. movie that I programmed for tomorrow night, I've seen.
Never heard of it.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. For a while, I think like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, all of these movies, there are only four of them directed by this English director named Joanna Hogg, were available to you know, for free to stream on Netflix and on Amazon and whatever. And they've all been pulled, I think, because like she's gotten a little bit more famous. I think Tom's been a little more famous. So again, so she's a woman named Joanna Hogg. She's in her 60s. She only started making movies when she was in her 40s.
Inspirational. I will take it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so she cast Tom, I think sort of like in his first starring role in one of her first movies, this movie, I think from 2007 or 2008 called Archipelago, which is about like this family, this sort of like dysfunctional family that decide to go away for a holiday before the son, played by Tom, goes off for a year to volunteer in Africa. And how that decision is sort of like doesn't come without like its own costs, and how it sort of basically make everybody in his family makes that decision about them. And then so that was like I think the first movie of his that this woman Joanna Hogg had directed. And then the second one, which is what we're watching tonight, is called Unrelated, and it's about a woman. I guess I may as well just like say what it's about, because like, you know, there isn't a lot of plot. It's about a woman in her 40s named Anna, who decides to join an old school friend, sort of like, you know, long like vacation in Tuscany, despite the fact, or maybe because of the fact, that she, this woman Anna, is fighting with her husband a lot. So the husband gets left behind in London. She's gonna go off to Tuscany and hang out with her old school friend, who she kind of knows, and like her, and sort of like her relatives, like her new husband, and like, cause they're like, so they're like the olds, like the people who are in their 40s and 50s, and the youngs who are the later teenagers. And of course, like Tom is one of the youngs, and so how.
And so is his sister.
His sister, yeah, amazing. Exactly. Yeah, his sister, Emma Hiddleston, who I don't know that she's acted in a while. So that was, I think, her first film role, was acting with her brother, but playing his cousin, not his sibling, in the movie. And sort of what happens basically when you're like a 40-something-year-old woman who doesn't, in Italy, but you don't really seem to have a lot in common with other 40-somethings, so you end up sort of falling in with like the 20-somethings and what happens there, so.
I'm very excited to watch it.
Yeah.
I am going to pull you back.
Ah, I know, sorry. I keep going off on tangents and yeah.
There's no apologizing for tangents, because that is exactly, you know, like I got to this podcast from drawing a mind map of like, if I thought, how did this get made in the middle? What are the movies I've watched to go to live shows? What is the TV and movies I've watched because I like Paul, June, and Jason?
Right.
What are the things I've started watching because they had a guest who I really enjoyed, like Nicole Byer, who now I watch Nailed It, and I listen to 3 of her 85 podcasts.
I can't believe she has so many podcasts. She has so many podcasts.
She's the queen. So the tangents are part of talking about your favorite thing. If it was your favorite thing and you're like, here is the 3 things I have to say about it. Well, that's not interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things that you are known for in Chicago is you are involved in the live lit scene.
Right, right.
Storytelling. You are both often asked to be on the bill, but you produce a show called Misspoken.
Right.
I'm curious if there's any connection in your mind between being given Lori Colwin these essays about ordinary lives, fast forward to the stories you tell in Live Lit in Chicago, which are the stories of, you don't tell stories about becoming a hero, you tell stories about your life.
Right.
You tell stories that make me cry. Your story about being, when you became an American citizen, right before the election, destroyed me. But the answer can be no, but do you see any connection between Lori Colwin's essays and how you participate as a storyteller or producer
of
Live Lit in Chicago.
I think it definitely affects not just the stories that I tell, but the stories that I want to hear, the stories that I want to program. Notably, I think first of all, when it comes to sort of figuring out what the themes are going to be, the themes, of course, for 2020 have been completely shot because of the pandemic. But so I've only been co-hosting Misspoken since the end of 2016. Carly Oishi left the show. She was one of the co-founders. And I co-hosted it with Rosamund Lannon until the end of 2019 when Rosamund left, you know, because she had stuff going on in her life, which is the same reason that Carly did. So I've been doing it on my own, but the process of sort of figuring out the themes has been the same, where you sort of sit down and maybe a word or a phrase comes in, you write it down and you think about it. And then it's December of that year and you realize people are wanting to know what the themes are for the following year. And I think because in the first, two or three years of the show, you'd sort of gotten rid of the big ones, like the ones relating to body image, like boobs or having your period or having a vagina or sexuality or relationships, like getting married or your first breakup or your last breakup and all that stuff, that had already been covered. And we were already at the point where there were certain topics where we could sort of file under categories like body image and being a creator or an artist or society. It was sort of categories on Jeopardy. And so I think I think I got pretty good at sort of figuring out when we'd come up with an idea for a category, be like, is this something that we haven't already done?
Right.
And if it is something that we've already done, does it mean that we're going to do it again because it works so great the first time? Or are we going to sort of tweak it to make it a little more interesting, right? And so I think for me, when it comes to certain topics, I don't like leaving them so open to interpretation that people will just come up and pitch whatever they want to pitch. And of course, I always say no, but then I always get really cranky when they pitch things that I didn't want to hear in the first place. Right. And I think that for me, I want to hear boring stories almost, because I think that what it comes down to is I'm always more interested in the person telling the story than the story itself. Because I mean, I'm not gonna be a jerk and say, oh yeah, we've had people in the past who were super interesting, they told boring stories. So it's why? Because I've been that person. I know that.
Yeah.
That for me, it always comes down to who are you as a person? Who are you as a storyteller? I don't have to like you, but I have to be interested in hearing you tell the story for the next 5 to 10 minutes, because that's time that you're taking from your life to tell me the story. And it's time that I'm taking out of my life to listen. So it should be compelling. It should be interesting. It doesn't have to be super exciting, but it should be a story. It should have a beginning and a middle and an end.
Yeah. You can have a beginning, middle, and end without a call to action.
Exactly. Right. It doesn't have to. I mean, if it is, that's great. But otherwise, that's not something that I necessarily look for. Although there have been times where people have gotten up and basically just sort of done a campaign speech. But I also feel like that was something that I needed to hear at that point. And I knew going into it, that's what they were going to say. That's sort of why I booked them, right?
I think you might be talking about me.
Yeah, I might be talking about you, and that's fine.
I definitely want my election one last year. I was like, get up, stand up, put your hand. It was really very much a Inga Mushio, that self-protection kind of a speech. It was a stump speech.
But I also feel like that sometimes that's what people need to hear, especially the people who roll up to the Gallery Cabaret on the last Wednesday of the month. It's it's friends and people that we know and people that we like. But sometimes those people need to be prodded a little bit and told hey, get the fuck out of your seat and do something.
Right.
And I'm not that person, because I'm always the first person to be like, I'm going to, you all do your fancy important stuff. I'm going to go lie down. I'm going to not, just because that's how contrary I am. So, but then even times like that, when you've got someone sort of speechifying or sort of on the verge of issuing a call to action, that's still comes from an ordinary sort of normal place. It comes from a desire.
Yeah.
It comes from the need to participate, to make yourself, to make yourself heard, which is something that I think a lot of people take for granted, And so people need to hear that shit. They need to hear every once in a while, you need to go vote. Yeah, yeah, I know. No, 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 you need to hear this from me. And these are the stakes, right? You need someone who you know who you trust, like Lori, or like, you know, or Leah, or sometimes even a Tom, if he's in the right role, to say like, this is what, like, you know, this is the story. This is what happens if you don't do this. This is what happens if you do this. And I'm not saying you should, but please go do this already.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do it like once upon a time, or I did do it and it was awesome. And
thank you so much for being my very first guest.
Oh, sure. I hope you can somehow delete the random traffic noises that still managed to get picked up by my microphone. I thought about shutting myself up in my closet, but it's we're now getting to that point in Chicago weather where it's going to be very, very warm very soon.
No.
And I would have suffered. It would have been an unpleasant situation for me.
Yeah. We have not reached the point of the, you know, this is not a high-end podcast with millions of subscribers. And in the future, when we're famous.
Right, yes.
And people say, you know, Leah and Jasmine, they weren't, like, they published their first books in their 40s.
Exactly.
That's when we'll have to start, like, covering ourselves in, that's when we'll have to start, like, putting a blanket over the computer. Or
we'll have podcast studios.
Yes. The world will reopen and we'll be allowed to go to a studio.
Yeah, we'll have a live audience.
What would you like to promote that is maybe timeless, like social media?
I guess Misspoken. That's something I'm always happy to promote, though. To be honest, I feel like right now the future of that is unclear. I think, you know, we've been doing these shows on Zoom and that's been fine, but I think you told me this, that the Gallery Cabaret is no longer, that the bars
be allowed to reopen after the
the landlord effectively evicted those guys, so we're gonna have to find a new home.
Misspoken is this amazing live lit series in Chicago that Jasmine is the current curator and producer of. It's the last Wednesday of the month. They book women and female identifying people to tell stories based around a theme.
Yep.
And all of the shows, or many of the shows, are archived.
Yeah, they're all available as a podcast. The performances are recorded and tweaked a little bit, and they're all archived, available through the Apple iTunes, the Apple podcast store. So
great. And how can people follow you on social media?
On social media, we can be found on Instagram and on Twitter, our handle, and on Facebook, and our handles for all of those is Misspoken Shy. So it's Misspoken Shy, as in Chicago.
Yeah. What about if people wanted to follow you?
They want to follow me. They can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram and Tumblr, because I still use that, as Jasmine D. So that's Jasmined.
I don't think I want to admit how long I knew you before I realized it wasn't Jasmine as an action verb. Be Jasmine. That it was actually your first name, last initial.
Yeah.
Too long. It was too long, Jasmine.
Yeah. I do occasionally get, well, maybe like once a year, I'll get a request from someone on one of those platforms asking if they can have my handle. And I'm like,
no,
no,
maybe not. Well, thank you for being my very first interview.
Yay, congratulations.
Finding Favorites.
Yay.
Who knows when you're listening to this world, if I recorded it appropriately, or if you're listening to round two.
Well, we have to do a round two. Maybe we can do it while we're watching a horny movie. Yes. That'd be funny.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jasmine.
Thank you.